Yes. Sorry.
You want to say that with a little more enthusiasm?
Yes. Yes! Okay, so...
Stop the podcast. Before we continue our regularly scheduled intro music, I have some important news for you about our format. We are now publishing 3 new episodes every week. On Mondays, we'll bring you our new standalone Below the Fold show. On Wednesdays, we'll have a guest for our long deep dive segment. And on Saturdays, we'll have the recording of our live Above the Fold show with WRGW, the student radio program here at George Washington University. You can listen to that live if you like every Friday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on WRGW's website or on iHeartRadio.com. I also have an update about a story for you. 2 weeks ago, I told you about CareFirst, a health insurer who's trying to get the Supreme Court to take up its data breach case. The justices have now officially denied that petition, letting the appeals court ruling stand. The ruling awarded damages to individuals who lost data in the CareFirst data breach, even though those individuals couldn't prove the data had been used maliciously against them. Welcome to a new episode of our new standalone Below the Fold format.
Woo!
So today we're going to have a whole half hour or hour or however long we go just talking about our Below the Fold topics. For new listeners, this is when we drill in on some of the subjects you may not have heard about because maybe they're just a little too wonky or a little too buried by some of the other bold headlines that day. So we've each come prepared with a story. My name is Eli Richmond. I'll be your moderator today. With me today are Kat Lundy and Haley Dunn.
Hi. Hello.
So, Haley, you want to kick us off?
I would love to kick us off. So, I have a super bizarre story. So, basically, this is about a strange medical condition that's been affecting American and some Canadian diplomats and their families in Cuba. It's something kind of like a mix of, like, James Bond and the X-Files, although... probably there is a relatively innocuous explanation. So basically, if you don't know, yeah, hopefully we're going to get our minds blown. So basically, if you don't know, about 22 Americans and 8 Canadians have been diagnosed with concussion-like symptoms ranging from nausea to headaches to hearing loss. Several have reported hearing strange and extremely loud noises from outside that kind of sound like cicadas, but also somehow mechanical. Another person described hearing a powerful beam of high-pitched sound that seemed to be pointed right at him. So, very strange reports. Other people didn't feel like they heard anything in particular, but since everyone else was going to the doctor, a lot of them went, and most of them went to Miami. So, the extra weird thing is that multiple investigations by different parts of the U.S. government have yet to turn up any explanation for this at all. So the FBI finally ruled out the possibility of a sonic-type attack device, but now they have even less of an idea about what happened and still no idea about any motive. However, the first 4 American victims were actually all undercover CIA operatives, and the CIA itself has not concurred with the FBI's decision to rule out sonic devices yet. Although, just scientifically, there's not really anything that's known right now that could be that well targeted at a particular person that's not super loud that other people would hear. So it's very bizarre. Some people were hypothesizing that this was kind of more like psychosomatic and an instance of mass hysteria where maybe a couple people had genuine symptoms like and then other people all freaked out. But actually, doctors are saying... that there's no evidence that this is a mass hysteria, and I think there were about, like, 56 people that went to the hospital. Out of them, like, 22 actually had real symptoms, but they had, like, a panel of physicians look through the medical records for 21 of the patients, and they wrote, quote, "If you took any one of these patients and put them into a brain injury clinic and you didn't know their background, you would think that they had a traumatic brain injury from being in a car accident or a blast in the military." So this isn't just, you know, some weird, I don't know, it's very strange. Basically, the Trump administration has accused Raul Castro's government of at least failing to protect the diplomats, if not outright causing the attacks. So early in the fall, the U.S. government pulled back about half their diplomatic staff from Havana and expelled about the same number of Cuban diplomats from our capital.
And Secretary of State Tillerson has justified this as a necessary measure until the matter has been resolved, because otherwise we'd be leaving U.S. citizens in harm's way. So the Castro government has maintained their innocence and stressed their complete cooperation. The FBI has found no evidence of complicity on behalf of the Cuban government. Another potential instigator could be Russia, so, like, bringing back some Cold War kind of shenanigans, because they previously have harassed U.S. diplomats in Moscow and elsewhere, and they do have the capability to develop something sophisticated enough to create some kind of sonic technology. But so far, there's been no evidence, even circumstantially, that Russia is involved at all. So besides just being downright strange, this is actually a really important story in terms of U.S. and Cuba relations, with the Trump administration using this kind of as an excuse to backtrack on having a closer relationship that kind of opened up under the Obama administration. We're also heading into a political transition in April when Raul Castro steps down, and now there's only going to be a handful of our diplomatic staff there. And a lot of Cubans are also offended that our Trump administration is accusing them of attacking U.S. diplomats, and they're accusing them of being an imperialist plot to damage their reputation. So
you mentioned at the beginning that you hoped it was an innocuous explanation. What is an innocuous explanation for this?
Obviously, I'm not an expert in any of this, but I love throwing out conjectures. So, I could see some kind of, like, biological contaminant. I don't know. So, it's weird that it would be so targeted. So, I'm wondering if it could still be some kind of, like, environmental fungal thing, or... I don't know. It's very sci-fi. But I'm also not sure that it makes sense to have, like, a weapon that's sonic. That, like, one man was literally saying he just thought they were very loud cicadas.
Whoa, that's very intense.
It's very strange. And other people have, like, heard it while in a building surrounded by other people who didn't hear anything. So it's like, you know, we have sonic, like, weapons now that they use for crowd control. But it's very loud, and that's why it makes you have a loss of hearing, is that it's just a huge, immense noise that everyone in the area hears. And people, like physicists or whoever does sound things, like, they can't explain, like, how anyone would have developed such a device.
I know that my dad was in the Air Force for a long time, and his office, especially, he always called it the vault, where basically you have to put your phone, before he walks into the office every day, he has to put his phone away. And that they constantly have music playing in the office, but that all the speakers are facing towards the windows just in case people have, like, microphones or pointed microphones so they can't get any of the information that my dad or his coworkers might be talking about. I've heard about stuff like that, or people targeting a military room because they know that these are where those secrets are kept and this is where these conversations about this technology is had. I've never heard about, like, a weapon to hurt people in that room. So, to me, if we're going with conspiracy theory, it would make sense to me that someone's targeting a room with, like, a listening device, and maybe it, like, malfunctioned or something, but
it's so weird.
A room with, like, a sound device is not unheard of to me, but this is also, like, you know, Cuba, where they're still driving cars from, like, 1940.
Right, like, I find it hard to believe the Cuban government.
Yeah.
Also, why?
Why? Yeah, that's the bigger question.
Yeah. Well, so also, let's dive back down beneath the fold a little bit more. Like, what are the policy outcomes of this? Like, what is this going to do in terms of U.S.'s policy toward Cuba?
Yeah, so I feel like Trump is already kind of trying to backtrack on the opening up of U.S.-Cuban relations. And, I mean, we haven't had a diplomatic corps there that long. Mm-hmm. So I see this as a pretext for just shutting down relations in general. I do also think it is kind of also emblematic of our reduction in our use of soft power, I think, as a country in general. And the idea, I mean, I don't want us to send diplomats who are going to have concussions without having concussions either. But on the other hand, especially going into a political transformation, not having a diplomatic presence on the island is unfortunate, because I do think that that diplomacy is especially needed now, and I think it would be a shame for us to not kind of foster a more open relationship with Cuba, like both for our own sake and because other countries are going to do it with or without us. And I think that it would be a shame to kind of see us go back to that stalemate where there's no trade or visiting or communication.
I would agree. I think the Trump administration is very quick to make enemies versus pausing to understand the bigger scope of a relationship. And if you're accusing the Cuban government of using sonic boom guns to, you know, create illness in your diplomats, yeah, that's probably a very reactionary approach. But I think that's also the way Trump is. Like, he knee-jerks he has a knee-jerk reaction to everything.
I also think it would be interesting if they did find evidence that Russia was involved, if that would just be added to the list of things that we know Russia is involved in and are going to pretend that didn't happen, or, I don't know.
Well, if we found out that, then Trump probably wouldn't care anymore.
No, exactly. We'd save U.S.-Cuba relations.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to our next topic, which is mine. So, have you guys filed your taxes yet?
No. Gosh.
All right, well, you better do it before scammers beat you to it.
What?
Yeah, and over the past several years, there's been a rise in the rates of tax refund fraud. So, this is when somebody else gets access to your W-2 or 1099 and then files your taxes so that they can get the refund. So if any of our listeners have ever tried to file their taxes electronically with the IRS and gotten rejected for your return, that's because a scammer already did it.
I did not know this.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
So the good news is that the rates of tax refund fraud have gone down a little bit in recent years. And that's a story of the IRS instituting some new policy. So there are three big things that the IRS did in order to address this. They started urging people who have fallen victim to identity theft to do paper filing, along with the identity threat affidavit form they're supposed to send into the IRS if they know they've been a victim of identity fraud. And then if the IRS thinks that any individuals are particularly at risk, it will send them a special PIN number that they'll need to enter along with their filing.
Who would be particularly at risk?
It's interesting. I guess people who are high profile or who work in the industry. When I was doing research on this, I came across an article by a journalist named Brian Krebs, who's one of the foremost reporters on cybersecurity and cyber attacks, and he said he's gotten one from the IRS for, like, the past 3 years. Oh, wow. And I guess because he's so prevalent in the space,
there's
some concern that he might get targeted. And then last of all, the IRS has a tool called Get Transcript, which some of you may have used, which is kind of a way of checking on your refund and checking the status of your filing. And this used to be very leaky. It would have all kinds of authentication problems, and the IRS has simply stepped up the amount of data authentication elements it needs you to sign in with in order to get information. So that's helped the rates go down a little bit in just the past year or two. But the other thing that the IRS could do to really cut down on this is the same silver bullet as a lot of tax issues, which is automatic tax filing. So I don't know if we've talked about this at all yet on Wonkast or Below the Fold, but automatic tax filing is a policy that many other countries have where if your employer is withholding your taxes from every paycheck, like the vast majority of employers do, the IRS already has most of the information it needs on your income. And so it knows how much taxes you should pay. And so this would just be a way of the IRS filing your taxes for you. And then they just send you a form being like, this is how much you need to pay. And then you would sign it and send it back and you would not need to do any taxes.
Would you not be getting a lot of the deductions and things that people claim now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is a concern people raise, but usually there's just an opt-out form. So if you would rather do your own taxes, you just download the form and send it in, and you don't sign the piece of paper that the IRS sends you that would say, like, this is how much taxes you owe. And so there are this has been an idea that's been thrown around a little bit in American politics, but I think it's lacked a real policy champion. And I think part of that might just be
because...
It's
not a very sexy issue.
It's not hugely sexy. I mean, we saw a little bit of action around it, this most recent tax reform attempt. You know, there was all this rhetoric about the postcard filing, like you'd be able to file your taxes on a postcard. That's kind of a very... I don't think that's really the problem. It's like a step before this, you know. If our tax system were so simple that you could file it on a postcard, it would be simple enough that the IRS could just automatically file it for you. That there is some social science to indicate that if taxes are more annoying to do, then people will hate them more. And so that causes certain right-wing parties and thinkers to push against automatic tax filing. Because, you know, people like Grover Norquist, who is an anti-tax crusader here in D.C., hates this idea because he wants Americans to be pissed off about their taxes every tax season.
That's interesting.
I was going to say, the joke all along is that he works for H&R Block, but that for sure.
And that actually, thank you for bringing up, that's the other major force in Washington pushing against this, is that
like
the makers of TurboTax and H&R Block have put in a lot of lobbying investment into making sure that this idea never sees the light of day.
Yeah. It's just really interesting, and I don't know if IRS policy has anything to do with this. Like, I know the one of the things I was learning in my politics and policy class last semester when we were talking about incremental changes done through legislation or sort of like using the tax code and taxes to help. A lot of taxes pay for a lot of social policy that we deal with. Like some, I should probably look this up. I just know that there are social policy and like social safety net programs that are paid for through revenue from taxes. And I'm not sure if one of the reasons why to like simplify it or what they were doing with the tax code bill earlier this year. I was just curious whether or not simplifying it will take away from those programs or possibly undo a lot of like progressive change towards social policy that have been done through the tax code versus like legislation. But there are a lot of people that think that that's unfair. If you're going to create social policy or funding programs, it should be done through appropriations through Congress and not through like our tax system, which is kind of secret and people don't really pay attention to that, or like everyday citizens, but they'll see like a big, you know, cuts bill.
Well, this wouldn't actually change any of the tax rates or any of the tax exemptions. This automatic tax filing, right, it would just change the collection method. And there may be some people who now itemize their taxes and who do the full process of filing manually, who might, in the case of an automatic tax filing regime, just go like, well, you know, maybe I could save a little bit of money, but it would be a huge hassle, so I'm just going to pay a little bit extra. So
yeah, see, I'm the kind of person where I'm like, I don't trust this. I'm doing it myself. Like, I won't even use TurboTax. I do all my own taxes myself.
I beg my dad to do it every year.
I think people largely come in two flavors about that. Like, you know, there's either like, yes, I want to see every single dollar I'm spending and why I'm spending it. And then there are the people who are like, this really stresses me out. I'd really just rather not think about it. And for all of those people, the automatic tax filing would be great, if they do have to pay a lot more.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad policy. I'd probably just be one of the people who would opt out.
Yeah, so, and you can. I mean, all you need to do is do it the old way.
One of the few things me as a millennial would do the old way.
Well, Kat, would you like to close us out with your Below the Fold?
I'm going to go back in time a little bit in November, where Washington Post reported that there is a D.C. tuition aid program. I don't know if you guys know what this is. It's DCTAG, which is D.C. tuition aid program. This is a federal grant that pays up to $10,000 for D.C. residents, whether you are a adult 24 years or older and have been a resident of D.C. for at least 12 months, up through like the applying for college process, and this grant grants you up to $10,000 to pay the difference between in-state and out-of-state tuition for people that want to apply to colleges outside of D.C. Since D.C. only has, and I double-checked it just now, one public university that doesn't really give poor or low-income students coming from D.C. very many options if they don't have enough money to afford out-of-state tuition. So this program has given
many DC students and young adults accessed higher education that they would not otherwise be able to pay for because the district being so small and so much land is appropriated for federal use, like the giant building that we pass by every day, this Capitol building, monuments, you know, museums and everything else that is run by the federal government. There's only one public school. In November, the Senate Appropriations Committee introduced a spending bill that would have cut the program by 1/4, which Mayor Muriel Bowser was, you know, of course, upset about. And so they were directed to, okay, let's just evaluate this program. And I think in that report, they actually admitted that there are some problems with it. Like, there is a, what they call, people in a certain income bracket don't qualify, but they were noticing that that income bracket is still insanely high. For the students that this program is actually supposed, or not supposed to, but is intended to benefit, like poor income, mostly minority students. Recently, and then we're going to jump ahead to, what was this? This published 2 days ago. Donald Trump wants to eliminate the entire program altogether. No review process, no evaluation. He's just like, no, we're done. We're done paying for it. And I think his exact words were, while this program has helped many D.C. students or D.C. residents afford college, the financial position of the D.C. government has significantly improved since 1999, providing D.C. with the flexibility to allocate local funds to support its residents. Mm-hmm. So this is interesting.
So that was in his proposed budget.
Yeah, it's gone. In November, the original spending bill, like, this is before government shutdown. This is before, you know, Nancy Pelosi stood in 4-inch heels and talked about DACA for 8 hours. What Trump has said, in November, it was just about reducing the program, and then we're going to do a formal process of reviewing and evaluating policy. But now Trump has come out saying, I don't want it at all. I want it gone.
Yeah.
But I would think it's interesting the way he has said, one, that the D.C. government and the D.C. residents' lives has significantly improved in 1999. When you add that plus gentrification of the area, yes, it has improved for, like, you know, the people that are moving back into the city since White Flight and the Martin Luther King riots that basically burned down almost all of Shaw. And then saying that we have the flexibility. His statement's just saying that D.C. has the flexibility to allocate local funds to have this program when we don't really have the flexibility to allocate funds because everything is still approved by a Congress that gets to vote on, you know, what our budget is. So I just thought that was very interesting that instead of going through the evaluation process, he's just wanted to get rid of it altogether.
Well, but that's just in his proposed budget. I mean, like, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if we should even, like, take the White House's proposed budget as a serious governing document. Because, Congress doesn't take it up. Over the past 2 years, Congress has not even started with that as a rubric, and then moved on from there. They've just taken the previous year as the rubric.
That's nice.
Yeah. It's kind of like, oh, okay, that's what you want? Great. We're gonna do our own thing. And then Trump signs it. So, like, why should we care what his budget lays out?
Well, one thing that I think is interesting is just, like, one is comments and then that growing attitude. Like, whenever people are talking about what they actually are talking about are politicians and policymakers or senators or congressmen, they always say, those guys in Washington, the people in D.C., the swamp. But there are, like, hardworking families that live here. There are, like, sometimes I get really upset, and I haven't lived here very long, but I live in a neighborhood with people that, you know, don't necessarily work for government. They're, like, regular working people. But the whole city is, like, blacklisted as this horrible place where politicians or, like, crooks go to, like, corrupt government. And it's just, I don't know. I guess I just personally get upset where I hate that that is the reputation. And then at the same time being told that we will control your budget, we don't give you the right to vote. Or, I'm sorry, your congresswoman doesn't have the right to vote. Also, you're not a state, you don't have senators. But you pay federal taxes. You pay into everyone else's benefits in the entire country. This is like me on my soapbox. Sorry.
That's what a podcast is for.
Yeah. In terms of, like, whether or not I could take Trump seriously in eliminating this program, I just think it speaks to our executive branch's misunderstanding of how DC policy works and how everything is sort of approved through Congress. Like, an example is, like, DC recreational or decriminalized marijuana became a thing in DC, but Congress would not allow us to, like, spend any money figuring out to how to create excise taxes for these goods. That's revenue that we now don't get.
Yeah, DC could, this is like one of my big, because marijuana policy is like my policy of interest, and it is endlessly frustrating because DC could really use some revenue from, you know, operating stores like other states.
I think that we do know where the money needs to go in our budget. It's not that, you know, there are people working in DC government that haven't gotten public policy degrees or public administration degrees or are economists or just like every other city and state government. So when I hear the executive government talking about how, oh, you can take care of yourselves, you know how to allocate your own funds, you have no understanding of how the city works, but on the campaign trail, you love dogging us the entire time.
There's yeah, a lot to unpack. It's just like, you know, he's done this twice now where, the White House, but, you know, it's his budgetary department run by Mick Mulvaney, who came in with the Tea Party movement, and it reminds me more of, like, the opposition budgets that Paul Ryan used to put out, just to show, like, what he would theoretically be spending the money on if he could have his way.
Remember those.
But, you know, it wasn't like those budgets were ever going to be taken up by the Appropriations Committee, and it would never be signed by Obama, because they weren't in power. But Trump is in power, but he's still proposing these budgets that don't go anywhere.
The only thing I would worry about is just people don't care that, or it's, you know, out of the spotlight that D.C., with a Republican-controlled Congress and Donald Trump, I wouldn't see it. And, you know, a congresswoman that has no voting rights can just get up there and talk, but Eleanor Holmes, but she can't vote on anything. It would just make me scared that the way they did this partisan push for the tax bill, and, you know, it's yet to see what's going to happen with comprehensive immigration reform, whether that's going to be just a one big partisan push, Trump gets his way on everything. I don't know. I'd just be really scared to see it as part of the budget, and then all these DC students that don't have any other way to pay for college, especially out of state, get to lose that opportunity. I just think that the way policy has been working since Trump has taken office is very, like, one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I love that speech by Nancy Pelosi, at the same time, there are plenty of Democrats that voted for that budget. Because I guess they had to, or whatever the trade-offs are that we don't see in the background. So as much as Democrats are in the news for, like, fighting for what they believe in, we forget, like, oh, that budget passed, though. Like, they did vote for those measures. But it makes great for camera time.
Yeah.
Really pessimistic. I'm so sorry.
Right. And on that note,
yeah.
Closing us out on a dark note. Thank you for listening to Below the Fold, brought to you by GW Wonkast, the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration's podcast. For more wonkiness, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle on all three platforms is at GW Wonkast. And you can send us love letters or hate mail at wonkast@gmail.com. Be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. I think we can mostly say where podcasts are found these days.
Yeah, right.
And today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher, moderated and edited by Eli Richman, with music by Pelle Gunther. Thanks for listening.
Dun 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 dun. That's the music.
Yeah. Oh, you can do the whole thing. I could have just, I wouldn't have even needed to cut in the music. I could have just left that.